Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 20th, 1998, and in the Fireside building this morning, we have Stephanie Paul Sow. Her session number is 98-6. The title is Honoring the Sexual Body. Let's listen in.
Good to see everybody. This is the third in a series of sessions on the Christian practice of honoring the body. And today we're talking about honoring the sexual body. It's an interesting week to be thinking about this question with all that has transpired in the last couple of days outside the village. Did anybody go to the forum the other night for discussion? I had to put my daughter to bed, but how was it? Was it a good discussion? Did issues of honoring the body come up? No. Well, what if you were here on Monday, we were doing biblical perspectives on the body and early church perspectives on the body, and we didn't really get to early church perspectives, so I thought I would start maybe by bringing in some of that stuff this morning. If you look on page 5, if you have one of these packets, if you don't worry, because we're not going to do too much with them this morning. So this might be an interesting place to begin. Early Christians, I think sometimes when we think about early Christianity's relationship to the body, we think about, you know, sexual renunciation, virginity, abstinence, refusal of sexuality in a way. And I'd like us to... I want to raise up a particular theme to guide our discussion this morning about even more contemporary issues. And I think early Christians might help us do that. Early Christians saw the body as a very interesting and urgent place to investigate the relationship between humanity's relationship to God. Because the body presented human beings, good morning, welcome, with our most vulnerable moments. Early Christians looked to the body, particularly at the moment of death and at the moment of sexual desire, to ask questions about our relationship to God. And this is because death and sexual desire seem to be two moments in a human life when one's freedom was in question. We can die even when we don't wish to, and we can feel sexual desire even when we might not wish to. And so early Christians were very interested in how the body robs us of our freedom, and very interested in recovering that freedom. So let's look at just a couple of these strange early Christian texts to get us started this morning. The first one is from Tertullian, who's notorious for his sort of misogynist statements. But if you want to see a good recovery of Tertullian, Susan Friel has a nice article in the last Good Courage that Holden Village published. It's out there on the table. She has a very nice recovery of him. But he says, strangely, I think, let us look at our own inner world. Think of how a man feels in himself when he abstains from a woman. He thinks spiritual thoughts. If he prays to the Lord, he is next door to heaven. If he turns to the scriptures, he is all of him present to them. If he sings a psalm, it fills his whole being with enjoyment. If he exercises a demon, he does so confident in his own strength. I think maybe there were things that Tertullian did not quite understand. but you can see the yearning in this, whether or not this is your own experience of your sexuality. You can see the yearning in this is for freedom, for the freedom to be present to God and the freedom to be fully present to oneself and to prayer and to scripture and so on. So that, in spite of really the strangeness of this passage, I think that's the underlying desire of it. The third passage gives you a better idea, I think, of the kind of freedom that early Christians were reaching for when they did abstain from sexual activity. This is a quote from The Life of Thecla, which is a sort of extra scriptural account of this woman named Thecla who, according to tradition, left her home and family to follow the Apostle Paul. And she, following Paul's teachings that it was better to marry than to burn and so on, she abstains from sexuality. She abstains particularly from marriage, which is the concern of the person speaking here. He's talking about Paul, and he says, "This man has introduced a new teaching, bizarre and disruptive of the human race. He denigrates marriage, yes, marriage, which you might say is the beginning, root, and fountainhead of our nature. From it spring fathers, mothers, children, and families. Cities, villages, and cultivation have appeared because of it. Agriculture, the sailing of the seas, and all the skills of the state courts, the army, the high command, philosophy, rhetoric, the whole humming swarm of rhetors depend on it. What is more, from marriage come the temples and sanctuaries of our land, sacrifice, rituals, initiations, prayers, and solemn days of intercession." In the imperial world that early Christianity took shape in, the body, persons' bodies were understood to be, as this passage suggests, in the service of the state, in the service of the city. People were to marry and procreate and make more citizens, and fill the armies and the courts and the high command. Bodies were understood very much as a commodity, which strengthened the political system. And so when some early Christians came along and said, you know, I think my body belongs to God, and so I'm going to make these choices about my body. I'm not going to marry, or I'm not going to engage in sexual relations, I'm not going to have children. This was very dangerous and countercultural to the imperial system, and you get complaints like this a lot in early Christian literature. So I raised this as a way of, first of all, trying to show that early, I think sometimes when we think of these early Christians who, you know, did such ascetic practices with their bodies, they seem strange and kind of unfamiliar to us and very different from us. And I think while their practices might be different, I think our desire is the same, the desire for freedom, the desire to say, my body belongs to God, my body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, my body is my own, and I won't put it in the service of, you know, a political system. My body belongs to God. And they're not, I think in that way, they're not as strange as they sometimes seem. If you look at the second passage on this list, this is a passage from Jerome. He says, "He whom we look down upon, whom we cannot bear to see, the very sight of whom causes us to vomit, is the same as we are, formed with us from the self-same clay, compacted of the same elements. Whatever he suffers, we also can suffer. In silken robes or rags, the same lust holds sway. Desire neither fears the emperor's purple nor keeps away from the beggar's filth." I think this insight into the body that Jerome had and that other early Christians had, that the body is what we all have in common, and we all have these desires in common and vulnerabilities in common. Is what God intends in that is for us to treat one another with more compassion, to look at people who seem very different from us and see that in fact we are very much the same, because what is suffered by one can be suffered by all, and what is desired by one can be desired by all, and that the vulnerabilities of this body are what really unite us together with the rest of humanity. If you've been in the bookstore, you might have seen a little book that Dorothy Bass recommended called Four Fidelities by a woman named Catherine Wallace. And this is a recent attempt by a mother of two children to give an account of sexual fidelity that is satisfying to her. She has the experience of sitting at breakfast one morning and her youngest son starting to cry into his cereal bowl saying, "Do you and Daddy use condoms?" And she said, she's like, "Where does this question come from?" And he said, "Because I learned in school, if you don't, you can die. And I'm worried that you're going to die." And so she started saying, oh, well, you know, when you have just one partner, you don't have these, you know, worries. And then she realized that her account of sexual fidelity was starting to sound like a public health sort of issue, you know, that it was really about, you know, protecting oneself from death. And she decided to try to give an account of faithful relationships, both heterosexual and homosexual relationships, any kind of faithful, committed sexual relationship that was theologically grounded. And something more satisfying to pass on to her children. And this is a nice little book. It has some nice stuff on the body in it. And one of the things she says that I think is so true is that, you know, the vulnerabilities evoked by sexual desire are just nothing short of stunning. And I think that's what early Christians understood, and that's why the body and sexual desire became such a theological place to interrogate for them, because the vulnerabilities evoked there are truly nothing short of stunning. They get us where we are. They hook into our understanding of ourselves almost more than any other kind of vulnerability. She notes that, you know, if we feel desire for another, we also, it becomes complicated very quickly, because we also want that one to desire us. And then we also want that one to desire that we desire them. And, it, you know, the relationships and the ways in which we make ourselves vulnerable to another in intimate relationships are very fraught with perils. There are all sorts of ways in which our very selves are on the line, and so many ways in which our very selves can be hurt or damaged. I've been coming at this question about how we honor the sexual body recently from the perspective of a parent of a daughter, because I want her to have a fulfilling sense of her sexuality. I want her as an adult to be in a relationship that's sexually wonderful and fulfilling, but I know from having grown up myself that there are so many pitfalls along the way, so many ways where our sexuality can be hurt or damaged. And so one of the things I've been trying to think about, and that I would value your help with, is how we as parents or friends or grandparents or sisters and brothers or children, how we have either been taught to honor our bodies, and particularly our sexual bodies, but I think it's all connected, and how we've taught others to do so. In my own life, I think back to, you know, I think back to the onset of my menstrual period and my father coming into my room and sitting on the edge of my bed, and me being so embarrassed, and my dad saying he was very proud of me and that this was an important moment in our lives, and me just, you know, wanting to sink into the bed as an adult, realizing that my poor dad was also very embarrassed. And but he did that for me, you know, he came and blessed my body and welcomed me and welcomed this new change in my body in a way that I think was, even then, as embarrassing a moment as it was, was a very precious moment, and that's kind of stayed with me throughout my life. Susan Friel, one of our directors here, tells a story of how when her girls were little and she would bathe, how she would sing blessings over every part of their body in an effort to teach them that they were children of God, made in God's image, and that every part of their body was beautiful and holy and sacred. And I think maybe others of you might have some good stories too about how you were taught to honor your body, or how you have helped another, a child, a friend, a sister, a brother, honor their body. Anybody have a story they can share that might help us get at this a little bit more?
My hunch is that You're asking the hard question. The question we'd all probably have a lot of quick answers for is all the ways that we survived our bodies not being honored.
Right, that's right. That's the other part of the, that's the other side of the question. And I think, you know, some of us have been wounded in our bodies in very deep ways, sexually often. And some of us may feel that we have survived it, and some of us may feel that we have not. And I think that's, you know, that's one of, that's the way we investigate our freedom. And one of the ways we investigate our freedom and our relationship to God is how we help ourselves and others heal from what you're talking about.
One of the things that it dawns on me that's different for my son than it was for me is some of the literature that is available to use and explain bodily processes. And I think of, you know, initially being sort of grossed out, but when my wife got us a copy of the fart book.
Yeah. There's all sorts of books for children about bodily functions now.
That kind of normalize.
Potty books, right.
Those have been important.
Okay. Okay.
All the messages I ever received were repressing, you know, anything. And so for me with our kids, plus we have boys, so, you know, the unknown of that is not knowing what limits, if any, to set other than, you know, privacy. Or
right.
I don't know, you know, what what is, you know, because you can, what is healthy and what's not, and there's thousands of schools of thought out there, and what, you know, to figure out what's right for my family is difficult.
Now, that's a really, really good point. I mean, I think if we go back to Catherine Wallace's assertion that, you know, this is where we are most vulnerable. It is hard to know where to draw those boundaries. Because, you know, our children do need privacy from us too. But, you know, we want to form our children in love and in affection and freedom and not in anger or frustration. And that's one of the real difficulties, I think, is knowing when to cross those boundaries and when to hold back. I mean, it seems to me that one of the things that's so important that doesn't have to do with, you know, interrogating our children about their behavior is creating families and communities, church communities, where the body is celebrated and cherished. Where sexual relationships, healthy, committed sexual relationships are celebrated and cherished. Where children get to see the pleasure of fidelity and the pleasure of the body rather than embarrassment and repression, as you say. But it's very difficult to know how to do that. One of the things I remember as a child is that my parents were always very affectionate with each other, and you know, they would hold hands on walks and stuff, and I think that's one of the things, and still do, my parents, but I think that's one of the things that shaped my understanding of, you know, love and sexual relationship, and so I think in part modeling is a way in which, you know, very private boundaries don't have to be crossed, but where we still teach.
I'm also intrigued, though, with the idea that, I mean, when I think about my sexual upbringing, it was extremely negative. It was filled with do's and don'ts and how awful everything was, and don't you ever get yourself caught in this kind of situation. And it was the tapes that get played over and over, very, very negative rather than positive.
Right.
So then as a parent, as you try and raise your child to be more positive in accepting the body, sometimes I think, though, that one of the most important things we forget, or something that I have found that I needed to do, was if we are only positive, if we are only expressing or teaching them about the beauty of what we're really doing is we're denying that part of ourselves that's there and that's it comes out somehow anyway.
That's right. That's
and we are products of our parents who were products of their parents who were products.
Sure.
And I think sometimes acknowledging with your children the negativity that I was raised with that's still part of me that I hope doesn't have to be a part of them is significant too.
Yeah, that's right. I think maybe speaking with our children about our own sexual upbringing is one way to do that. And I think knowing where we're grounding our instruction about sexuality is really important. And if we understand in ourselves that it's grounded not in don't you ever do this, but it's grounded in I really want you to know what a fulfilling sexual relationship is, and there are choices you can make as you're growing up that can really damage that and make that very, very hard to achieve as an adult. Some things, you know, are out of our control, and you know, if we're abused or violated, then there's a whole other set of issues there. And we all hope very much, you know, that our children will not experience that. But if they do, you know, we need ways of talking about that too, and helping that not be the only defining thing that happens to them in their lives.
Maybe education has failed here in the explanation of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Guys go into this without knowing anything. I mean, females, a complete mystery for many.
Right.
You know, and so they have been taught nothing about the female anatomy. And what we learned in the barn didn't help.
Yeah, right.
I think it did. I think it helped a lot.
I didn't notice. But it seemed to be maybe more of a problem here, the body, women's body being more of a mystery to the men than vice versa, where women grew up babysitting and having that exposure. But there doesn't seem to be any two-way education here. The girls go to class on their own, learning about their own bodies. But I don't think they learn anything about those guys running around with testosterone. And the guys aren't learning anything about the girls.
Yeah, right.
Now, whether a good understanding of all this would help, I don't know.
Well, it could hurt.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, how do we learn about each other? I mean, how do we do that?
Trial and error.
Because as Michelle says, often we don't understand each other either. You know, it's not like we have as adults have all the answers. I mean, I think what we have is a desire that our children, you know, enjoy rich relationships. But how to get there is very hard. Anybody have a positive story about how you were taught to honor your body or how you have taught someone else to honor theirs?
Well, I think I would have to say I didn't learn it. Didn't get that kind of positive stuff from parents.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy is 3 and 4 years older,
mm-hmm.
some of whom had parents who did teach pretty straight down the line.
Mm-hmm.
I recall very vividly that today we call him a juvenile delinquent. The only Catholic kid in our little country school who was placed there because something was wrong in his own family.
Right.
Assured us, other guys, that true sexual involvement was the highest form of love under God. That's what my mom
said.
So
interesting. Oh, that's wonderful.
I can hear Raymond saying that.
Yeah.
Raymond said a lot of other things too. You know?
Yeah.
And when I was 10, the only time I went to Bible school, our 16-year-old cabin counselor paraded around nude, telling us that his having pubic hair and us not mm-hmm. having it. And the size of his testicles as compared with ours mm-hmm. just meant that he was truly a fertile man under God. And that's what was in store for us.
And that's what was in store for you.
Wasn't, I don't think it was negative.
Yeah, no.
It was kind of macho.
Right.
That's right. But some real health there because somebody had given him some pretty good information that he passed to know.
Well, yeah, I mean, how amazing to have children speaking theologically about the sexual body as you
and I can tell you the place on the road in walking between the church and the school where my cousin, whose mother was my godmother, had the wisdom on asking, what is this, when he found her tampax box in the closet, and she gave him a good explanation without reprimand as far as I know, and he passed it on. I know to this day it was pretty darn it.
That's good.
A kind of honor.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and we had a girl in the group at the same time who just said, that's about right. Mm-hmm. That was the end of it for that day. Mm-hmm. But boy, it was sure it was. And then, was it negative?
Yeah, no, absolutely not. No, it wasn't so negative at all. And you certainly didn't receive it as such.
No. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's wonderful. Thank you. Anybody else? Upstairs with me. Yeah.
Well, it was difficult growing up, as I did, in a family of all girls.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have any brothers.
Mm-hmm.
My father was, I can't remember his ever talking to us about anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
See, I can't even talk about it.
It's hard. Oh, but it's hard. Yeah. Don't worry.
So, actually, my husband, I guess, was the first man I ever really saw.
When you're in the nursing profession, in medical field, if we don't go overboard, sometimes I remember my sister who was a nurse was saying, well, you don't use the washcloth on private parts and then use them on other parts of the body. That's just not done because too many people are. I said, how much does that say about our not being comfortable with our private parts? They're just probably cleaner than any other parts of our body. And it shouldn't be looked on with such distaste. It's such a simple little thing, but it's part of our whole being of daily care.
Well, I think it is those little things that we remember, that children remember, the little ways we honor our bodies and take care of our bodies. I mean, that's why I love Susan blessing every part of her daughter's body and she face, because they'll remember that. You know, they'll really remember that. And it's such a small thing, but it's something you do every night. You take a bath. And I think that's, that bathing and dressing and undressing, those are some very daily, simple ways that we do, or we can, for paying attention, connect with the vulnerability of our body. Where I think, and that's I think where the sacredness of our body is really located, in its vulnerability, in the fact that we need each other to care for each other's bodies. You were going to say something.
I grew up, I think, in a different generation where my junior high school, we had sex a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents talked about sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a good thing. The one thing about the sex ed classes was that they were really very much, they weren't about the emotional or psychological aspects of sexuality.
Very clinical.
Yeah,
that's my experience, isn't it?
The sexual.
Here's this part, and here's this part.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which, probably would be just as important as, I mean, both parts are important, but I think that was something that was missing. Mm-hmm. And probably still is missing in sex.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard, I guess, in school.
Well, good information is at least partway there, right? But
yeah.
But it is, it's somehow odd to have that information cut off from all of the ways that, you know, that makes us vulnerable, our sexual makes us vulnerable. Yeah.
Is there anywhere in your outline or anything that crazy Pauline passage about the less honorable parts are given the greater honor?
Right.
I can't quote.
Yeah.
But it's a befuddling passage to a growing up boy who is getting some of these negatives, you know, don't use your washcloth both ways, this kind of stuff. What's honorable?
Right.
Is that in your package?
No, it's not. I don't even know where that is. Do you, John, right offhand? But I mean, I think there's a lot, as we saw on Monday, a lot of confusing things, especially in the Pauline works, about the distinction. You know, it's a very dualistic world, and so there's the body and there's the spirit, and the spirit knows the right thing to do and the body can't quite do it. And but there again, I think it's that longing for freedom, which is, I think, what we can help our children with. I think that's something we can raise up for them, that longing for to say, you know, your body is your own. I mean, you know, I read a statistic recently that more than half, or maybe more than half, but a huge number of teenage pregnancies are babies born to a teenage girl and an adult man. I mean, there are just all sorts of ways that, and I have more experience with girls than having been one, but that girls feel, you know, the ways in which girls need help resisting the coercive power of others on their sexuality, and boys too, I'm sure. There's also, you may remember several years ago that got a lot of attention, there was a sort of a gang of boys in a school, they called themselves a posse, and they got points for every time they had sex with a girl. And when they interviewed the girls, many of the girls said they thought they had to participate, they just felt obliged to participate. It seems that, you know, if we helped our children understand the freedom that God desires for all of us, especially in relation to our bodies, that, you know, children, young people, boys, girls would have they'd have more help, more strength in resisting really powerful coercive pressure on them, sexual pressure.
I wonder if the kind of a wrong understanding of the term flesh in the New Testament might be misleading for
us. I think that's right. I think that's right. You know, where flesh is talking more about bodily appetites and less about these bodies. But I think the way those texts get received and the life they sort of have in congregations and people's lives, people do read those as body, spirit, and spirit is good and body is bad. And we need help understanding the yearning in those passages for freedom and for good relationship and right relationship.
Although I don't know Greek, when I think of the word flesh, I also think of in John, it says the word was made flesh.
Yes, exactly.
And so it's the same word, but whenever we see flesh used outside of that passage, we think negative. And I'm assuming it's the same Greek word, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, and it's like the word world. It means it's used in two different ways. I mean, it's got the world geographically, and then you got the word world used theologically in a sense of what's wrong with the world.
Right.
Yeah. And flesh as being flesh in terms of biological, perfectly neutral, good, is over against flesh versus spirit, that which is wrong with us.
I'm glad you bring up the incarnation. Someone has had to do this for me every session. I keep not bringing it up about the body. But I mean, that's it, right? I mean, that's what the Christian practice of honoring the body is rooted in. Based in is that, you know, something as fragile and vulnerable as the body can bear divinity and manifest God's presence, and that our bodies as are both strong and fragile, and also can bear the light of Christ within them. I think if you were here Sunday night and you heard Susan Briel's wonderful sermon about the luminaria, the skin bags filled with dirt that also show forth the light of Christ. That's a great image, I think, for the body. Skin bag full of dirt that can bear the light of Christ. I mean, that's, you know, that's the great contribution I think Christianity has to make to the whole question and the whole practice.
Martin Luther doesn't help, really, though, there. The devil in the world and our own flesh.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that we have to fight against.
Our ancestors are so complicated, aren't they? Sometimes they help us, sometimes they don't help us, yeah.
But, I mean, when you think about Jesus, you think of someone who was celibate.
Or asexual, yeah.
And that, I mean, I know, and so there's not, in Christianity, I find it hard to tie in spirituality and mm-hmm. sexuality, but mm-hmm. For instance, I know I've read some about Hinduism, and I know mm-hmm. that in some Hindu theologies, mm-hmm. sexuality is seen as a divine energy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, man.
So there's a real tie in there,
right?
Theologically,
right?
Whereas,
right.
I don't know, it just seems on the surface, I haven't really.
Yeah. No, I think you raise a good point. I mean, I do think that's a good point. You think about the tradition of the virgin birth, you know, that Jesus born without the sexual act. And I think, yeah, we do tend to think of Jesus as asexual or celibate. And I think the Christian practice of honoring the body is not just lying on the surface of our tradition. I think we have to really dig into it and excavate it in a way. But I think it's there, and I think it's grounded in the incarnation, the idea that the body is, sacred and holy, and the, the great vulnerabilities that our bodies bear are precisely the things that can draw us together, and that, when I always feel that God gives us over into each other's care through these vulnerabilities.
I think we also, as we look at Scripture and are clear about the long and hard work mm-hmm. of Scripture's evolution,
mm-hmm. right.
And how people needed to dance
right.
with it
right.
to make certain points
right.
in their communities,
right.
that even in what is preserved, Jesus, I think we can see in Scripture a pretty fully human Jesus
right.
who breaks all kinds of traditions
right.
by his allowing his connections with women
right.
to be so startling.
Right.
So, I mean, it's a very intimate act to have someone crying, weeping on your
right.
feet. Well, I mean, unheard
of. Right, right,
yeah.
right, exactly.
So I think there's some stuff right. in Scripture we can kind of mine a little
I
bit.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right.
Jesus doesn't quite come out quite so asexual.
That's right. That's right. I mean, those passages, yeah, I mean, weeping over his feet, wiping them dry with their hair, that's a, when long, loose hair is a sign of sexual sin, is a very potent passage.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I think that's right. Let me offer one resource to you for recovery of tradition. And the honoring the sexual body stuff starts on page 8, and two pages after that is a poem I'll share with you. This is a book that I highly recommend by a colleague of mine named Pekla Kramer-Kinsky. Is a Jewish scholar, studies history of Judaism, ancient traditions. She knows a lot of old languages, Sumerian, Akkadian, all these languages I didn't begin to understand. And she, when she was getting ready to have her first child, she had to go to the hospital for an emergency C-section. And she, doctor just said, gather up everything you can and get to the hospital, and you're going to be there for a couple hours, and we're going to deliver your baby. And so she'd been working on these, I think they were Sumerian birth incantations or something, and she brought them with her to the hospital, and she read them there and really prepared herself for the act of giving birth. And she realized later, most women can't take their Sumerian incantations to the hospital and read them. And that there was so much in ancient Mediterranean traditions and in, you know, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, that that might help us think about the act of giving birth. And so this is just a beautiful book of prayers and poems that she's written for about menstruation, about miscarriage, about trying to get pregnant, about what, there are these great prayers of, you know, pushing, and, you know, they're just great. If you have any, you know, anyone who's expecting a baby, it's a great gift. But she goes through and tries to recover. She tries to excavate these traditions in the way that John describes that we need to do with Christianity, to recover some ancient wisdom about sexuality in the body. And one of the things she really focuses on is menstruation, you know, which is so often in the Bible described as, you know, the time when women are impure, ritually unclean. And she remembers that blood is the great purifier in the Bible. You know, blood purifies the altar, blood purifies all sorts of things, and tries to recover that. So let me just read you this poem. I really like this poem. It's called Blood the Pure. My grandmother and my grandmother's grandmother and all our grandmothers since eons forever believed my blood unclean. Do I know better? For my doctors and my teachers and my doctor's teachers have explained that the flow is a cleansing, removing from my body matter unneeded which can only decay. And surely I knew or should have known that my blood was a cleansing, for it cleansed the altar at the time of sacrifice, purified the altar at the time of dedication, sprinkled the altar at the time of atonement, and anointed the clothes of Aaron and his sons at their consecration. Blood splattered on the horns of the altar purified it. Blood poured on the base of the altar consecrated it. Blood sprinkled on the mercy seat implored it. Blood which I have been taught to hide so carefully purifies the sacred, purifies me. So that's one example of someone returning to their tradition, which is a mixed bag for them, you know, which has given them contradictory messages, and trying to gain some wisdom from it, and trying to recover practices and teachings about the body that are theologically powerful. This, I think, is very theologically powerful, and something wonderful to share with a daughter who's just menstruating. So that's one example. I think we need more and more of this, you know, more and more of these creative interactions with our traditions. You know, she writes a poem that's very grounded in scripture here. She's a very, very creative woman, and I think we need more and more of that in our churches and in our homes, of recovering wisdom from our traditions. Let's see what else I have here. Oh yeah, the Song of Songs. There's a wonderful place to look. Let me see which one do I want to look at. Look at number four. This is a passage from Song of Songs, chapter 3. Upon my bed at night, I sought him whom my soul loves. Now, of course, what happens with this poem later in the tradition is, which is also a very beautiful thing, people like John of the Cross and other Christian mystics page 8. Other Christian mystics take this poem and read it as being about the relationship between themselves, the soul, and God, or the church and God. In fact, when I got married, my husband was Roman Catholic, and we have a dear friend, Chrysogonos Waddell, who's a monk at the Abbey of Gethsemane, which is the monastery where Thomas Merton lived. And when we got married, he wrote to my husband and said, you must be to Stephanie as Christ is to the church, and, you know, quoted all the Song of Songs stuff, which is great. But anyway, upon my bed at night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him but found him not. I called him but he gave no answer. I will rise now and go about the city in the streets and the squares. I will seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him but found him not. The sentinels found me as they went about in the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I passed them when I found him whom my soul loves. I held him and would not let him go until I brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the wild does, do not stir up or awaken love until it is ready. There's lots in the Song of Songs about the vulnerability of sexual desire. The next passage, which often gets read at weddings, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is as strong as death, passion fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, a raging flame. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. If one offered for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly scorned. Passion is as fierce as the grave. That's great stuff. And so true. And definitely a resource within our tradition for honoring the body. The other passage I have here is that one from Genesis 2 where it says a man leaves his father and his mother and clings to his wife and they become one flesh. Where it is, the week sets in here. I'm thinking about honoring the body. Because it seems to me one of the real mysteries of the body is that it can help us draw near to others in intimacy, but it also, the body is what keeps us separate finally from each other. We can be as intimate as it's possible to be with another person, and we're still not one flesh, not really. We can still keep secrets from each other. And I think that's why passion is as fierce as the grave, right? Because we don't ever really become one flesh. We're still in these separate bodies, and being separate in that way means we are doubly vulnerable, I think. We talked about this a bit on Monday, that, you know, when that I can't feel the sexual desire of another. I can see the signs of it. I can't feel the pain in another's body. I can see signs of it, but I can't, you know, if Michelle is in pain, I can't feel it. I can't feel her tooth aching or her stomach hurting. And Michelle has to rely on my imagination and my compassion to take care of her. And I think this is why, you know, I think this is why torture is possible. Because we can't feel the pain in another's body. And it is possible, sexually and otherwise, to objectify other bodies and be present when other bodies are in great distress and in great pain and do nothing. And we always have to be working against that. We always have to be, I mean, that torture is an extreme example, but we all always have to be working against objectifying and marginalizing some bodies. And I think our culture encourages this. You know, there are various times in history, I mean, you know, the Holocaust, another extreme example, some kinds of bodies get so objectified that people are able to kill them in great numbers. We always have to be guarding against that. And I think that's the claim of this practice of honoring the body on our lives, is learning to see, learning to regard with attention all human bodies as sacred and as holy and as belonging to God and as bearing somehow the image of God's goodness. White bodies, black bodies, wounded bodies,
homosexual bodies, heterosexual bodies, all bodies, as deserving of great care and attention, because all of them bearing somehow the image of God. So I see that we're at the end of our time, but does anybody have a last word before we close?
Well, we haven't talked about fashion and business.
That's right.
Throw out this subject from culture.
That's
from one
right.
end of the world
That's
to the
right.
other.
There's so much that works against this practice. That is so true. And so much in our culture that wants to say there's one way of being beautiful, there's one way of being desirable, there's one way of, you know, your sexuality is about yourself. You know, Susan Briel and I were talking this morning. I'm trying to write a little book about honoring the body, and she said, you know what you need to do? You need to read women's magazines for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. You know, how to have a better orgasm. 10 things men wish women knew about them. You know, that there's so much that that works against this practice.
One of the things that I have found is that if we're struggling to find the language or the comfort zone to talk about some of this, that simply offer people the option, would you rather talk about your giving patterns or your sexuality?
Either your checkbook or your sex.
That's right.
Talk about sex. That's right.
I just sort of have one last comment, though, too, and it's something that Dennis and I have been sort of struggling with and thinking about a little bit. And a lot of the talk this morning had to do with the girl.
Right, that's right.
And,
that's right. And the
young girl
that's
coming
right.
to her time of
that's
beginning
right.
menstruation.
That's right.
How easily it is to sort of celebrate that.
That's right. That's
you know, and I think back to Sarah, and we were conscious of her sort of insecurity, and so...
Right.
There was another woman and I went with Sarah. I mean, the whole idea of the old, the wise women taking the young girl and the coming of age, and we went out to dinner with her and we had a great time. And her dad actually wasn't nearly as forthright as your father was, but gave her a watch that had both a moon and a sun that circled on it, and that was sort of that. But we talked about the fact that we have done nothing with Paul.
Right.
Because the outward sign,
right.
you know, at what point do you celebrate a young man right. coming to manhood, and it's not nearly so clear, and that's a real
right.
frustration too.
Yeah, that's a really good word to me, especially because I tend to think, because I'm a woman and I have only a daughter, I tend to think of this in terms of women. But you know, it's interesting that your stories have to do with boys talking together. And luckily, the boys who talk to you are these very theologically astute boys, you know.
Right, because the default, without that kind of wisdom that you experienced, is the boys in the barn
right.
setting up the order of who's going to get laid first.
Right.
I mean,
right,
that's
exactly,
sort of...
Exactly. Yeah, on this topic, I really do recommend that book by Catherine Wallace, because she's the mother of two sons, and she really is trying to... think about how to talk to teenagers about the power of their desire.
Yeah. One other comment.
Please.
I think John's comment about the giving, your giving
pattern
or your sexual pattern are
not
too far apart.
Not too far apart.
I think we have to see our sexuality at both male and female as the giving to fulfill the other rather
that's
than
right.
ourselves.
Well, that's right. That's
and
right.
I think that's
right.
what...
That's right.
It's gifted.
That's right. And that's too, I'm really glad you said that. That's such an important point, and I wouldn't want that to go unmentioned. And I think Scripture really does help us with that, and the stories about Jesus really help us about that. That when he girds himself with a towel and bends down and washes the feet of his friends, the message about touching there is you touch out of a desire to, out of a generous desire. And not to just get something for yourself, but you touch another in order to give them pleasure. And that's hugely important in all of this. Well, I really thank you. This has been very helpful to me. And tomorrow, if you can come back, we'll be talking about the body in prayer and worship. So thanks very much for coming here.